Hello and welcome to Informed, a podcast series where you'll hear industry experts share their thought-provoking insights and lessons in the field of medical communications. This series is brought to you by ISMAP and is generously sponsored by MedThink SciComm. My name's Rob Mathias, and I'm president and CEO of ISMAP. The COVID pandemic both accelerated adoption of decentralized clinical trials and highlighted the importance of decentralization in making clinical trials more patient-centric. These trials allow for the continuation of research in challenging periods, as we've seen recently with the global pandemic and even in times of war. They don't, however, need to be viewed only as fallback methodologies, and there's actually numerous benefits that make decentralized trials a methodological option and not just an alternative. For example, they have the potential to improve patient engagement in research and certainly help with equity, diversity, and inclusion. Today, we're going to address what decentralized trials mean for publication and medical communication professionals. What have been the challenges? What have been the learnings? What will be the trickle-down effect into publication planning? And where do these trials fit within other methodologies such as real-world evidence and patient-reported data? Here to talk about decentralized trials is Craig Lipset. Craig is the co-founder and co-chair of the Decentralized Trials and Research Alliance, which is the industry's largest not-for-profit collaboration exclusively focused on the global adoption of decentralized research. He is also board vice chair for MedStar Health Research Institute and vice president of the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research. Welcome, Craig.
Thanks, Rob. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
Craig, I thought we would just jump right into it. And, you know, our listeners may actually not know what decentralized trials actually are. Can you help us understand them?
I think starting with a definition is a great place to begin, not only for listeners who may not be familiar with what they are, but for some who may have a perception that it means one narrow example. When I think about decentralized trials, I think in a very expansive way about the use of technology and processes that can enable visits to take place outside of a traditional research site. So this is a story about technology. There's e-consent and use of video and remote patient monitoring and digital endpoints. And it's a story about processes like home health and visiting nurses, or extending our supply chain so medicines that are investigational can reach people at home, or even how we can acquire labs and imaging closer to patients' homes. But it's a story about using those innovative processes and technologies with a particular purpose, to create scenarios where patients do not have to go to a traditional site in order to participate. That could mean they're participating from home, but as we're starting to see more and more today, it might mean that they're participating from a retail pharmacy, a pop-up site, a mobile site, or even their own treating physician's office.
That's really cool, Craig. I'm wondering, are these going to replace traditional clinical trials, or where do you see them in the placement of the broad spectrum of research?
I think these are a collection of methodologies that will continue to get inserted into and included in more and more of our clinical trials. There will always be extreme examples that are not well suited for these types of approaches. But what we're seeing is more and more across therapeutic areas, across phases of development, we can include in a thoughtful and responsible way many of these different methods and approaches. It doesn't mean that all clinical trials aspire to take place in people's homes. But when we take this view that this is just a set of methods available for study teams that can increase options and flexibility for patients, I think we start to see that more and more of our studies can include decentralized methods within and enable some, if not all, visits to have more choice for people.
Interesting. So when I grew up in this field, I started off thinking, you know, there was just traditional clinical trials and then HEOR research, real-world evidence. So where do you see this fitting in relative to real-world evidence? Are there similarities, differences?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, we think about real-world evidence in a lot of different ways in the research organization today. Certainly, there are the studies that maybe we can run just using real-world data sources to build bodies of evidence around a medicine that may already be on the market. But we also are excited about using real-world data to help catalyze and power our clinical trials of investigational medicines. When visits are taking place away from a traditional research site, we can't compromise on the diversity of data that we want or need to answer our research questions about efficacy and safety. And so in these decentralized trials, we're starting to see more and more uses of real-world data as a part of a prospective clinical trial to make sure that our bodies of evidence are sound and have high integrity. So what does that mean? That means that some of our work with eSource to electronically source study data for prospective trials from electronic health records, from devices, wearables, and other connected tools, all of that seems to be coming together and converging today around decentralized trials. Because once again, the investigator site honestly may not even have an EHR about me anymore. It may not be a physician that I've ever seen. That investigator might be across town, across the state, across the country. And so my ability as a patient to connect and bring in my real-world data is going to become an even more prominent use case.
That's really amazing, Craig. I'm wondering, when we think about these types of trials, are they trusted? Or do they suffer from some of the challenges that traditional HEOR and market access types of research suffer from?
You know, when we think about trust, there's really two key guardrails for us that we always have to keep in mind. Can we trust in terms of patient safety, and can we trust in terms of data integrity and our ability to be able to infer with confidence results? These are immovable objects, right? If we can't demonstrate that, then we can't really use these methods with any reliability or confidence. And data integrity in so many ways for us traces back to the measurements and endpoints that we're relying on for the studies. Now, more and more over the recent years, more and more companies, research sponsors have been investing in digitizing and modernizing our endpoints. And those are critical steps to be able to take, to be able to decentralize our research with confidence. When we are relying on an endpoint that requires patients to come into the clinic for visits, we're trapped. We don't have the ability to flex and meet people where they are or have resilience in our studies. Think about a 6-minute walk test requiring people to come into the clinic for each visit. We know we can modernize these endpoints, and more pharma have built smart digital medicine teams within to begin this journey of modernizing our measurements. When we modernize our measurements and we're using digital tools as a part of that process, we don't compromise in terms of data integrity and data quality. We're going through the thoughtful process of qualifying and validating those measurements. And those that we're acquiring digitally tend to be pretty agnostic when it comes to location. You can use that smartphone and watch from home, from work, or from a research clinic. They don't care, but they ensure that we're getting our data with confidence, regardless of where the patient may be.
It's amazing. It sounds like the sources of data that we can get are just overwhelming at this point. And I'm thinking now with my hat on as a traditional publication professional who's going to be writing up some of these studies, what do you think some of the implications are for the folks listening to this discussion and how they might view their publications moving forward?
Well, there's certainly some new methods that we're going to have to be familiar with and be able to explain in an appropriate way to our different stakeholders. I think that more and more, if we can start to rally and harmonize around certain terms and jargon, it's going to help the whole ecosystem. And we're seeing certain glossaries emerging that can help us here. The IMI and Trials at Home has a glossary, and a lot of that work is being incorporated into a broader glossary that will be open and available from the decentralized Trials Research Alliance, DTRA, that you had mentioned during the introduction. When we can rationalize and use consistent language, especially with some of these newer methods, it'll help our different audiences and stakeholders in terms of being comfortable and building confidence in these approaches. And that's why some of our definitions get either in our way or it can be great catalyst for us. But we're also going to see some other things that seem new when we're thinking about how to explain our studies. What is an investigator site is a question we never really had to ask much in the past. It was pretty straightforward. It was a brick and mortar building that patients traveled in and out of in order to participate. But today, is your retail pharmacy a site? Is an RV rolling into the community a site? How do we explain this and categorize it for people to understand again? But I hope that as we are thinking about our publications, we're going to start start to see more and more of the upside. And that hopefully will represent itself in one of the most obvious ways around including more diverse and representative patients in the trials that we're sharing.
So it's interesting. I was going to ask you about that. What do you think are some of the impacts from a diversity inclusion perspective of these types of trials?
I think the most obvious impact from a diversity and inclusiveness perspective is around the impact of improving access for people. Now, certainly that means that those who are in remote geographies can have improved access because they don't need to be able to travel to a site, as well as those who may have different socioeconomic circumstances, such as needing to work at certain hours, and when they're not at work, they're not getting paid, or having childcare and other burdens, or just the cost and burden of having to travel across town to get to a research site. So we do know that we see some impact and some improvement associated with improved access, bringing more inclusiveness in studies. But decentralized is hardly a silver bullet. It is just a tool. One of the barriers for many is access, but a true barrier for many communities is trust. And so in many ways, to get the full impact of decentralized, it has to be a dish best served paired, and pairing it with other diversity commitments and investments, those that are aimed at improving trust with different communities, decentralized then can hopefully reach its fullest impact in terms of helping us to truly enroll a representative patient population.
It sounds like there's just a whole variety of benefits, particular for patients and access associated with these trials. And I'm wondering, from the publication professional perspective, where can they go to get more up to speed on this so that they're more prepared for these types of trials as they emerge?
That's a great question. We're continuing to share resources through DTRA. There are certainly a number of white papers and others, but we're working to really build a body of evidence based on actual experience across the community rather than having to rely on just anecdote. I enjoy hosting a clubhouse and audio session that we host every Friday, open to the public, 12 to 1 or Eastern time, where we address different topics related to decentralized. You can certainly follow me on LinkedIn to keep up with more of that evolving space. We're watching regulations in terms of guidance and other positions from different regulatory authorities, and they're taking a lot of different forms, such as the Oncology Center of Excellence from the FDA having certain requests about flagging and tagging certain data fields captured this way. We're even seeing the term decentralized incorporated in legislative initiatives. There are two pieces of bipartisan legislation in committees today, both the Cures 2.0 Act as well as the Diverse Trials Act, both of which call out decentralized by name. So it's a good area to stay on top of. There's certainly a lot of rhetoric and hype, but hopefully if we can make sure we're exposing the right information through different channels, we can help all of our stakeholders to stay current in this field.
That's great. And I bet a number of our listeners will be incorporating elements of decentralized trials and learnings into their development plans so they can be better adept at being able to write them up in publications.
I would think so, Rob. And I think, you know, to the point you were hinting at earlier, you know, so many of the factors for improving, for using decentralized are patient-facing. Can we improve recruitment, retention? Can we impact diversity and access? But I think another factor coming out of the pandemic is the appreciation that these approaches can also be important business continuity countermeasures in an unpredictable environment. And we certainly saw the rise in adoption during the pandemic when the environmental risk was greater than ever before. And it really catalyzed teams to adopt tools that had been available, but maybe were viewed as risky. But I would say that for many study teams today, including these measures, is not only a tool for improving patient factors, but it's also going to be an important tool for us in terms of business continuity. There are so many environmental factors that will continue to conspire to make it challenging for patients to consistently get to research sites in order to participate in studies. I don't know if it's the next pandemic or war or whatever that environmental factor may be, But we do know that this can become an important continuity measure to make sure that patients can access study drug and research teams can continue to monitor for safety and efficacy.
I do agree with you. I think it was a bit of an awakening that occurred when we suddenly had to use some of the tools and things that we, you know, perhaps had available but never put into play. One last question for our pub professionals out there. The tools that are available to them, like the glossary you mentioned, what types of other things might be available as people are starting to put these pubs together?
Well, I think that the glossary hopefully will be helpful. I think that as we're able to build and share more bodies of evidence, that should as well. We should start to see a global mapping tool that can help teams that are operationalizing at global scale be able to track policy, regulation, and other considerations at global scale. And so tracking and monitoring regulation and policy on a country-by-country basis and sharing that in an open way, but also then working together with regulators where we do have gaps in knowledge or gaps in what they may consider acceptable or have concerns. And again, making sure that we can put sunlight on those so that study teams know what to expect when operating in different countries. Hopefully those tools, along with some of the different policy initiatives and trusted communication outlets, will help all of our stakeholders in terms of staying current and informed.
Craig, thank you so much for taking the time today to join us and to talk about these centralized trials, give us a sense of some of the resources and areas where we can develop. It's certainly an area that's not going to go away, and I think it's prime time to have this for our listeners so they can have a better understanding. Really appreciate you coming on today.
Rob, I really appreciate your taking the time to include this emerging and exciting field for your audience and all that you're doing to keep them aware and engaged and informed of evolution that's happening today in this field.
Thanks so much, Craig.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Informed for Medical Communication Professionals. Please take a minute to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app, inform your colleagues, and rate our show highly if you liked what you heard today. We hope you'll also join us at an upcoming ISMAP University webinar or even consider becoming a member of our association. Just go to ismpp.org, that's ismap.org, to learn more. I'm Rob Mathias.